into adaptation fund, and we find these families and people still in problems around flooding, and there's no help to actually alleviate that poverty and those problems.
People speaking in solidarity with the people of the Philippines hit by Typhoon Hagupit over the weekend. Some 900,000 people were forced to.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, also heard on the web at www.kboo.fm. The time is 5 o'clock. Stay tuned for the KBOO Tuesday Evening News coming up after these messages.
Hi, this is Sun Lee, the membership coordinator at KBOO Community Radio. I just want to take a moment to say thank you to all the people that made our three-day December drive a rousing success. From our volunteers that answered phones, created great programs, and engineered live music, and to all of our listeners that called in or donated online, and to the restaurants that donated food for our volunteers. I would also like to thank and welcome the 40-plus new members to the KBOO community. Without your support, KBOO would not be what it is today. Thank you.
Help support KBOO Community Radio by donating your used car, truck, motorcycle, boat, or any other vehicle. We'll transform the old machine into resources for unserved and underserved communities, free training, recording equipment, and great programming for the Portland metro area, Cascadia, and the world. For more information about vehicle donation, call 1-877-KBOO123 or go to kboo.fm/vehicle.
And this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Volunteers of America, Oregon, committed to helping 17,000 vulnerable people of all ages in our community live better lives each year. You can learn how to help by visiting the website at voaor.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission is holding hearings on the Jordan Cove Liquefied Natural Gas Project.
Members of the group Don't Shoot Portland met with Charlie Hales, our mayor, to talk about police violence.
And the U.S. Intelligence Committee released its report on the CIA's detention and interrogation program.
And this breaking news just in, the Measure 92 recount will go ahead as planned, as a Multnomah County judge has rejected an attempt by the measure supporters to stop the state from certifying the results of the recount.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, December 9th, 2014. I'm Emily Young.
And I'm Jared Dantzler.
A meeting was called between the mayor's office in the city of Portland and a group calling itself Don't Shoot Portland. Don't Shoot Portland organizer Teresa Rayford gave testimony along with several other community members. The meeting was called in the wake of several street protests that have occurred in connection with the shooting death of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, and the chokehold death of Eric Garner in Staten Island, New York. Recent street protests have been very vocal, frequent, and have been a direct challenge to the city's power structure. Community members have voiced their perception that the Portland Police Bureau has unnecessarily escalated the situation with the use of pepper spray and flashbang grenades. The PPB has also resorted to a tactic known as kettling, in which protesters and often bystanders are rounded up indiscriminately and arrested. According to Hale's spokesperson, the mayor's office will hold monthly meetings with the group for the next 6 months. KBOO reporters Paul Rowland and Jimmy Tardy were at City Hall today and bring us this audio along with excerpts from a live streaming video made possible by a community member.
What do we want? Justice! as a parent, I have two young black men. Like, what? I need you to understand that when you tell your sons to do everything right, it still doesn't matter. Like, you can still, and it gets me emotional because I'm going to have to see them dead one day. Like, not just personally my sons, but everybody's sons. Like, this is personal to me.
We're waiting for funerals in our community.
Exactly.
Yeah.
My brother was shot out here. I grew up out here. He was killed and murdered in the streets, not by officers, but still, like, this is something that needs to be handled. Like, if that same violence was taking place downtown, you can sure believe that stuff would be taken care of. Because I tell my sons all the time, my son has been in the car with me while I've been pulled over for my taillight not working, yet we get out the car, the taillight's working just fine. And I can go for 100 different occasions. I'm sure everybody can too. But it's like, what do you tell your sons? What would you tell your kids? This is something that my kids have to go, not yours. You're talking about people that are Americans. If there's something wrong with your character to the point where you don't respect your fellow Americans,
you shouldn't be in office.
Then you should not be in office. You should not be in a uniform. You should not be teaching in a classroom. If you have a problem with your personality or your character that tells you to think negatively about a fellow American in this country, somebody that you're supposed to be united with under the United States of America, then that means that you're not part of our America.
There are plenty of cops who are out here just bullying people, and how do you not see this stuff?
They don't need training. They need to be excluded from the opportunity to serve us. We don't spend money to make you feel more comfortable around us.
I'm here in front of City Hall where the meeting is just wrapping up between the group of protesters calling themselves Don't Shoot Portland and the mayor's office. I'm talking with Teresa Rayford. I was just asking her about what she felt about the meeting, the mayor's attitude, and the process that this went through to come about.
I really believe that a lot of our community members felt insulted by the entire process, the meeting, and everything that happened within there. But I do think that we made a first step. We broke past our gatekeepers, and he was able to speak directly to the public. We want to continue that. The public is going to be working with the IPR. We're going to have a couple of sessions this month so that we understand process and law and policy, so that we will be educated in what we're asking for, so that we'll have a full understanding of how it's going to benefit us. But we are looking forward to 6 months of changes, building change by dialoguing directly with the mayor, the union president, and anybody else that'll take the opportunity to meet with community members. We don't need our gatekeeper organization speaking for us anymore. We're trying to break these gates down.
Do you feel like this is at least a first step in building some sort of relationship with the power structure here?
It's a direct contact. It's a direct engagement. And we do want it to get bigger. And we do want it to become louder. And we want it to be very productive. That's why we're going to go ahead and make sure that education is available to our community members. So once they become part of that involvement and that engagement process, that they're educated enough to know what benefits them on the outcome. Because a lot of times we have people that are telling us what's best for us because they're sitting at the table, and then we find out later that those things are basically taking away more rights, basically creating more injuries. You know, they're not facilitated in a way that benefits us directly, but sometimes it works for the people that are sitting at the table. It's not working for us right now.
Anything else you want to say?
Just everybody stay engaged. Go to Don't Shoot Portland, like the page, and stay engaged. Become a part of the process. We want to change things.
First, let's talk about what neighborhood we're referring to. That was audio from today's meeting between the local protest group Don't Shoot Portland and Portland Mayor Charlie Hale's office.
The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, the FERC, is holding a series of public hearings around Oregon this week on the proposed gas pipeline and liquefied natural gas export facility in Coos Bay. In November, FERC released a draft environmental impact statement, or DEIS, for the Jordan Cove LNG project. The draft environmental impact statement said that the project will cause minimal environmental damage. The hearings, which began in Coos Bay yesterday, will give citizens a chance to give their input on the decision. This evening's hearings in Roseburg and a rally of people opposing the project is going on right now. We have on the line Richard Chasm of Landowners United in Roseburg. Hello, Richard. Are you there?
I'm here. Thank you.
Hey, Richard, can you tell us why you're there in Roseburg?
Well, these are important hearings. The federal government is allegedly interested in our input, and so they're holding public hearings all this week. Last night, Coos Bay, Roseburg, Canyonville, Medford, Klamath Falls, and on Saturday.
And how many people have come out to the hearing tonight?
Well, I haven't gone into the actual hearings. I'm outside, and there's probably 30 or 40 people here, and they've unfurled a banner of no LNG pipeline that we got from a group up there in Portland that is the width of the pipeline right away east of 100 feet.
I understand that the proposed natural gas pipeline is going to export. The export terminal would pass right through Roseburg.
Well, you know, not Roseburg itself, the town, but it flashes across all of southern Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
Goes over the Cascades down by Klamath Falls and the Lake of the Woods Wilderness, and it crosses the Rogue River at Shady Cove and the South Umpqua River at Milo and then Clark's Branch on I-5, and it goes underneath the Coquille River twice and terminates on the north spit of Coos Bay.
Passing through some of these major bodies of water and landscapes, what are some of the concerns of Roseburg residents specifically about this project?
Well, I think that it was interesting to listen to your last interview because, you know, you remove the specifics of the location and it's very similar. There's been a process, but it's been Williams Pipeline has controlled it. They wrote the EIS and we get to comment on it. There's safety issues. There's process issues about how this whole thing's being done. And should they get a certificate of need and necessity, they'll be given the right of eminent domain to take the right-of-way. And they offer you what they think it's worth, pennies on the dollar. And if you don't like it, you can go to court and fight about the money. But they still have the right-of-way.
Are you expecting more people to come out and testify for or against the project?
Yes. There we had a big crowd last night in Coos Bay. Tomorrow night in Canyonville should be very interesting because there are a lot of people that are really down in the hills, I mean, really out there in Tiller and Milo and Drew, who are not going to drive on a rainy night into Roseburg, but they will come to Canyonville. So there will be some pretty serious comments.
You said some folks won't be making it in. How are folks generally organizing against the pipeline other than the hearing?
Well, there's a number of different organizations, the Global Warming Coalition, Landowners United, which is real specific to impacted landowners in the pipeline, No California LNG, Pipeline Awareness Group, the Democratic Party, and other different organizations. And in the last 6 weeks, 8 weeks, we've really started talking together to develop bona fide coalition, you know, typical human beings, but we all really don't like this. It's a bad idea. It benefits the wrong people.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Richard. We've been speaking with Richard Chasm of Landowners United in Roseburg.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity.
A group of neighbors in rural Washington County west of Hillsborough are organizing a campaign to challenge the expansion of the urban growth boundary into their area. The boundary was expanded to include an area east of Cornelius during the legislative session earlier this year in what came to be known as the land use grand bargain. But this group of residents call it shady backroom dealings in the halls of Salem and are worried about the future of their neighborhood as a result. For more, KBOO's Jinka Soderberg spoke with Joe and Amanda Oth and their neighbor, Sarah.
First, let's talk about what neighborhood we're referring to here, and then we'll talk about some of the land use issues.
We're referring to Dairy Creek West. We're located on just north of the Tualatin Valley Highway between Northwest 341st Avenue to 334th Avenue.
I understand there was a grand bargain in the legislative session. What's been happening with the land use there?
Well, the typical process that happens when land gets incorporated into the urban growth boundary is that the local jurisdictions then move forward to change the zoning to an urban zoning. And so once the grand bargain took place, the Washington County passed Ordinance 785 that made most of the land as future development zoning, that basically prevents any further development of rural area. So you pretty much just kind of fixed to a single family home use. You cannot expand any rural uses or farm uses on the land.
What happens with incorporation? I know some people say there are some advantages to incorporation. You get more services, that kind of thing. What do you see as the disadvantages?
The main disadvantages are that we would not be able to have our farm animals that most of us actually have. We do a lot of backyard farming, and geese would not be allowed. We've been told by city officials that they would not be allowed, and other farm animals, llamas, sheep, cows. So that's our major concern, and our neighborhood is still very rural, and there's a lot of people who want to continue practicing those rural activities.
And Sarah, you live in the same neighborhood?
That's correct. I'm actually a fairly new, I'm a newcomer to the area. My husband and I, we bought the house about 3 years ago, and we were looking for the kind of area that Joseph and Amanda just described. We wanted a place where we could have a large garden and have animals, and we have young children. I wanted a place where they could run outside and be gone for hours, and I didn't have to worry about them. You know, just out in the fields and the trees and playing. So, yeah, that's what we were looking for.
And is the fear now that this that expanded development is going to threaten that, along with incorporation?
Absolutely, absolutely. There's always a chance that, you know, fortunately right now, because our zoning is still rural, that won't happen in the very near future. But I don't want to see apartment complexes, or we're fairly close to TV Highway, and there's a large empty plot of land in between us and there, and I'm worried that we're going to get some sort of little strip mall or something else that's going to attract more people close to our house. We like our privacy, and I like the ability to send my kids outside to run and play.
And just to step backwards, how did this grand bargain come about that expands the urban growth boundary in the Cornelius area particularly?
Well, what happened was that Metro and Washington County did a urban and rural reserve process, which is they looked at zoning areas as rural and urban reserves. And this is, it's just a planning designation. It doesn't impact anybody's land, but it's what they plan to, where they plan to expand the urban growth boundary in the next 50 years. But it's not, it doesn't guarantee that they will expand the urban growth boundary where the urban reserves are. A group called Save Helvetia, they worked with 1,000 friends, and they took Metro and Washington County to court and they to challenge the urban reserves in the Helvetia area, and they won the court case back in February. So the state legislature was in session at the time, and they basically saw what this, them winning the court case, and they didn't want Washington County and Metro redo this entire planning process over again. So they quickly arranged these meetings that occurred on February 21st and February 23rd, and it was not open to the public. There's no meeting minutes. There's no attendance sheets. From what we heard, it's all side conversations. What we saw in a letter from Safe Helvetia, it was elected officials and developers and a bunch of organizations, and they kind of drew the lines of where they redrew the urban and rural reserves maps, but they also took one giant leap, and they also expanded the urban growth boundary by 1,178 acres as well through this. And then they, 4 days later, they quickly passed House Bill 4078, not giving any form of notification to the public to comment whether they want to be in or out of the urban growth boundary. One thing I want to touch on is that we're hoping to get our land out of the urban growth boundary this upcoming state legislature session, but if we're not successful, I mean, at least we get this this whole thing, more awareness of what happened to our land through this, what they call the land use grand bargain, what we call it as the backroom deal, because we want to make sure that this doesn't happen again. And we have seen in the newspaper recently that Clackamas County wants a similar thing done for their area. So I'm hoping that the people in, there's some way that we can make the people in Clackamas County aware of what happened to us so it doesn't happen to them, and so they can get active so there's not any form of backroom deal that happened regarding their land. And so I think it's really important to just get the word out of what happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I think a lot of people aren't familiar with the backroom dealings of the state legislature. And there's a session coming up, and so I think it's pretty important time for people to pay attention and find out what's going on. And again, the website for your group or your community organizing is 334th Avenue. If people are interested in connecting, even if you don't live in Washington County or in the Cornelius area, you can connect and find out how those struggles are connected across the region. I've been speaking with several residents of Washington County, and they are working to protect and to try to bring back the rural character of the neighborhood without the urban growth boundary expansion that's going on right now. 334thavenue.org is the website. And again, I've been speaking with Joseph and Amanda and Sarah. Thank you for joining us today on KBOO.
Thanks.
Thank you.
This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO Radio.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Protesters Monday made sure nations negotiating the Trans-Pacific Partnership in Washington, D.C. know there is widespread and significant opposition to that trade deal. Hundreds gathered for a noisy protest against the trade deal and against fast-track authority for President Obama to negotiate and ram it through Congress. Teamsters President Jim Hoffa says American workers are tired of being casualties of bad trade deals that send jobs overseas, and the voices of millions of working Americans cannot be ignored. The Communications Workers of America's George Cole says his union believes in trade, but not in trade deals that guarantee corporate profits at the expense of working families around the world. 1,500 graduate student employees at the University of Oregon are entering their second week of a strike over paid sick and parental leave. They say they're facing union-busting tactics as they head into another round of mediation. GTFF Local 3544 spokesman John LaRochelle says it's ironic that this issue triggered the strike.
One of the most troubling things about this whole situation is that the interim president of the university, Scott Coltrane, is a national expert and leader on the issue of paid leave. He said explicitly in an Atlantic article back in December 2013 that covering lost wages is key to mitigating long-term loss of earnings for taking parental leave. So we've been looking to him to be a leader on this issue, and instead we've gotten strike-breaking.
The strikers are affiliated with the American Federation of Teachers. Rochelle says the striking grad employees are getting strong support on campus.
I could not be more impressed with the work that my union and our allies on campus have done to push this campaign forward. It's been an incredible and unifying experience for us, and I'm looking forward to carrying forward in a strong way, regardless of what happens with the contract.
Grad students at the University of California, Santa Cruz, marched and walked out of classes Monday to protest tuition hikes of 5% per year for the next 5 years. Robert Kavouris is a PhD student and a member of UAW Local 2865. He says the increasing corporatization of campuses contributes to these tuition
tuition hikes, and neither students or campus workers are benefiting from them.
AFSCME, the union that represents many service workers in the UC system, as well as the union I'm a part of, the UAW 2865, as a teaching assistant, we were both in contract negotiations last year, and in both cases, the university tried to cut costs on our backs at the same time that they raised tuition. So, and if the tuition is not going to the services that students need to live here and to learn here, and it's not going to people that work here and the people that teach here, then it's clear that this money goes somewhere else.
Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from union-owned and represented Bank of Labor, member FDIC, equal opportunity lender. The Bank of Labor is the bank of choice for unions and their members. Now you can do business with a bank that shares labor values. More info online at bankoflabor.com.
You've been listening to WIND, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for a report on the upcoming Portland City Council meeting to discuss possible withdrawal from the Joint Terrorism Task Force. Followed by Out Loud Queer News and Culture at 6 p.m., we'll hear from Nika and Kahlo, a duo who comprise both a romantic relationship between two women and a local hip-hop performance duo. Hear them talk about music, life, struggle, love, and queerness in the Rose City. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio News and Views from a hip-hop perspective. It will rain tonight with low temperatures around 54 and breezy with gusts as high as 18 miles per hour. Tomorrow, more rain, heavy at times, highs near 58. Today in history, in 1941, China declared war against Japan, Germany, and Italy. In 1958, the radical right-wing John Birch Society was formed. And on December 9, 1987, the first intifada began in the Israeli-occupied Gaza Strip, one day after an Israeli truck crashed into a station wagon carrying Palestinian workers, killing 4 and wounding 10. The quote of the day is from Palestinian diplomat Asif Safifa. The tormenting dilemma of the Middle East is this. Either we have one people too many or one state too few.
It's 5:27 p.m. and it's time for Daily Commentary from Jim Hightower.
As the weather turns colder in this month of Christmas, Hanukkah, Kwanzaa, and the winter solstice, our hearts grow warmer and our thoughts turn to kindness and goodwill toward all. Unless, of course, you're Chris Christie. The governor of New Jersey is a mighty big man, both politically and physically, but the portly 250-pounder who hopes to win the Republican presidential nomination in 2016 recently used his gubernatorial power in a way that shows just how small of a man he really is. Just before Thanksgiving, Christie vetoed a bill that would have banned the use of gestation crates by industrial pork producers in New Jersey. These things are metal cages used to imprison pregnant pigs, and they're so small that the mothers can't even turn around. Amounting to animal torture, the cages are among the cruelest devices of the generally cruel factory farm system. So cruel that McDonald's, Burger King, Wendy's, Costco, Kroger, Sysco, Hormel, and scores of other food giants have pledged to stop buying from pork producers that use them. The Jersey Senate voted 32-1 to ban the cages, and its assembly voted 53-13 for the ban. Plus, an astonishing 93% of Jerseyites want them banned. Christie, however, contemptuously rejected the people's will with a dash of his infamous snarkiness, calling the ban a solution in search of a problem. Actually, he's the one on a search. Only a year from now, voting for the GOP presidential nomination begins in Iowa, a state with more pigs than people, and a state where the corporatized hog industry commonly uses gestation crates. So mama pigs must be sacrificed in order for Christie to win the Iowa pork vote. This is Jim Hightower saying, maybe if we loaded this cynical big man into one of those pig cages for, say, 5 minutes, he'd begin to understand the problem.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Roughly 600 pages of the Senate Intelligence Committee's report on the CIA's detention interrogation program was released today, a fraction of the 6,000-page investigation. The so-called torture report is a blistering indictment of the secret CIA detention centers used to interrogate suspected terrorists in the wake of 9/11. It identifies several instances of routine misinformation to the White House regarding detainees, the brutality of their treatment, and the lack of success in, of interrogation methods. In one instance found in an email, the CIA director requested the false reporting of a detainee numbers from 119 to 98. The committee further concluded that 26 of these detainees were wrongfully held. Their investigation also provides disturbing details of torture methods, such as medically unnecessary rectal feeding or rectal hydration, forced sleep deprivation up to 7 days, and violent waterboarding. Several Republican Party members and intelligence officials condemn the report's release as a divisive partisan tactic that will result in protests. Democrats, including President Obama, have responded with conviction. As committee chairperson Dianne Feinstein said, quote, "History will judge us by our commitment to a just society governed by law and the willingness to face an ugly truth and say never again."
Protesters from Code Pink disrupted the opening of a Senate Foreign Relations Committee hearing earlier today.
No more war. U.S. intervention is counterproductive. It'll only recruit more people to ISIS. The weapons will end in the hands of more war.
This committee will come to order.
The hearing was held to discuss the Obama administration's request for a new authorization for use of military force against the group Islamic State. The only witness was Secretary of State John Kerry. The administration wants to have a new open-ended authorization, but Committee Chair Menendez wants a 3-year limit. The president has in the past asserted that no ground troops would be deployed in this effort. The administration now wants to remove all restrictions on the level of force to allow for use of ground troops. Secretary Kerry is also asking Congress to eliminate geographic restrictions from the authorization in order to expand the conflict between Syria and Iran. Senator Rand Paul and others on the committee are critical of the administration's request. The committee hopes to mark up a new authorization by Thursday.
Members of Congress may get to go home soon after all. The Associated Press reports that budget negotiators have come to an agreement on the new federal budget. The fiscal year ended on September 30th. Government operations continue to be funded under what's called a temporary continuing resolution. That temporary resolution ends at midnight on the 11th. Members of Congress had hoped to give an omnibus meeting bill finalized by Monday in order to bring it to a vote this week. That effort failed, but AP and other sources are now reporting that an agreement has finally been reached on the omnibus spending bill. Details of the budget will be available after the bill is posted online later this evening. Disagreements in the budget debate stem from policy issues rather than funding levels as members try to insert various riders into the bill. A new temporary continuing resolution is also being prepared to keep the government open in case Congress fails to adopt the new budget in time. Congressional leaders hope to avoid another government shutdown, which could still occur if Congress fails to pass a new budget before adjourning.
The U.S. Senate Judiciary Subcommittee on the Constitution, Civil Rights, and Human Rights held a hearing earlier today on the state of civil and human rights in the United States. The senators heard from several witnesses, including Senator Cory Booker, Laura Murphy, director of the ACLU's legislative office in Washington, D.C. Following is from an opening statement by the ACLU's Murphy.
We are standing at a crossroads in America right now. One must only look to the current crises in Ferguson, in New York City, and in Cleveland to see that extreme problems in policing continue. With recent police paramilitary tactics splashed across our TV screens, we must ask ourselves, do we want an America where the exercise of First Amendment rights is met by assault weapons, and tear gas, where armored vehicles are used in our day-to-day policing, where policing resembles our military operations in Iraq and Afghanistan, where communities of color are disproportionately under siege. If the answer to these questions is no, Congress must act immediately. Militarized policing goes far beyond Ferguson. Although SWAT teams were originally created to deal with life or death emergencies like hostage crises, they are now overwhelmingly used to serve search warrants in drug investigations. A recent ACLU report found that SWAT teams were used 79% of the time for raiding a person's home, most often for drugs. Such tactics are unnecessary and excessive. What message are we sending by using weapons of war to police American communities? Congress must ensure accountability. Federal funding and providing military equipment should be conditioned on data collection, use of body-worn cameras, anti-racial profiling training, and insistence on community policing, as my good friend has pointed out. The war on drugs has created an incarceration nation with too many people in prison for too long, serving no useful benefit to society. One of the major reasons for expanded jail and prison populations over the past 30 years is the use of stiff mandatory minimum sentencing for nonviolent offenses. Prison costs now absorb nearly a third of DOJ's discretionary budget, 30%. The cost, though, go far beyond simply the money it takes to incarcerate over 2.3 million people. The true costs are human lives, mainly of generations of young Black and Latino men and women who serve long prison sentences and are lost to their families and communities. Organizations across the political spectrum support truly bipartisan sentencing reform, such as the Smarter Sentencing Act, and we thank you for that. That act would address the ongoing crisis in our federal prisons by reducing the prison population. The SSA is sponsored by Senators Durbin, Lee, Leahy, Cruz, and Representatives Bobby Scott and Raul Labrador. The bill also has considerable conservative support. The time is now to pass the Smarter Sentencing Act. It's only a first step in reducing over-incarceration. There's another tragic outcome of our nation's incarceration binge. Almost 6 million of our citizens have lost the right to vote because of a past criminal conviction, in many instances for very low-level crimes. Upon release from prison, these citizens work, they pay taxes, they live in our communities, and they raise families. But millions cannot vote. One out of every 13 African Americans of voting age has lost the right to vote. That is four times the national average. But millions have no input on our political process. That is unacceptable. We commend Senators Ben Cardin and Rand Paul for their leadership in this area, and we urge the passage of the Democracy Restoration Act, a bill that would restore voting rights in federal elections to millions of citizens. Ending discrimination should be, and historically has been, a bipartisan issue. Just consider the multiple Voting Rights Act extensions that we've had. Consider the laudatory Fair Sentencing Act of 2010. These would not have happened without bipartisan support. Only with bipartisan support can we make much-needed changes to our criminal justice policies. And I'm sorry Senator Cruz had to leave, because we would like to work with him as well on changing our criminal justice policies. We look forward to working with him as the new chair and all members of this subcommittee in the 114th Congress on these critical issues.
The U.S. Senate Judiciary Subcommittee on the And now the latest and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Tuesday, December 9th, 2014. Israeli settler attack a Palestinian teenager and tanks open fire at Gaza farmers. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Palestinian sources have reported Tuesday morning that an Israeli tank fired a shell into a farmland east of the Al Buraj refugee camp in central Gaza. The sources said that the shell led to excessive damage. No injuries were reported until the time of the report. Eyewitnesses said that soldiers stationed near the border fence fired the shell, adding that the attack was unprovoked, especially since a number of villagers were just working on their lands. Israeli soldiers frequently attack Palestinian farmers in areas close to the border fence and repeatedly deny them access to their lands, in direct violations of the Egyptian-mediated ceasefire agreement on August 26, 2014. Elsewhere, Israeli soldiers invaded various Palestinian communities in the occupied West Bank, including Jerusalem, searched and ransacked several homes, and kidnapped at least five Palestinians. In other news, an extremist Israeli settler attacked and stabbed a Palestinian teen late on Monday evening near Bani Nu'aym town, east of the southern West Bank city of Hebron. The sources said that Mu'adh al-Rajabi, 18 years of age, was stabbed in his shoulder and thigh and was moved to the Hebron governmental hospital, suffering moderate wounds. The attacker fled the scene. Israeli soldiers arrived at the scene but did not attempt to locate the assailant, eyewitnesses said. In related news, Israeli soldiers attacked and beat up Ahmed Yusuf Musharka in Dura town, south of Hebron, causing several fractures and bruises. Soldiers gave no reason for their attack. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Tuesday, December 9th, 2014, news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi, Amni, Ressa, Bannura.
Swedish torrent site The Pirate Bay was taken down due to a police raid that seized several computers and servers. The raid infiltrated a server room in Stockholm all over alleged copyright infringements. The Pirate Bay's forum site Super Bay was also taken down. Other torrent sites, including EZTV, Zoink, and Torage, were taken down as well, though it's unclear if they were raided. The Pirate Bay has been a target of conviction since its founding in 2003. Pirate Bay's co-founders have been convicted of copyright infringements in past years. Regardless of the convictions and previous raids, the Pirate Bay retained its online presence.
As the nation grapples with the lack of indictment of police officers in multiple cases in cities across the country, longtime political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal today released a commentary with his take on the situation. Here is Mumia's commentary, called Beyond Rotten Apples and Broken Windows, recorded from a phone line from a Pennsylvania federal penitentiary.
Beyond Rotten Apples and Broken Windows. The massive demonstrations rocking U.S. cities from coast to coast are loud and visible reflections of the deep anger and antipathy rising up against the long and bloody train of police terrorism. If you have read my writings or listened to my commentaries, you know that I describe police violence as what it is, terrorism, not brutality. For the aim of all police violence is to instill terror in black populations, just as was the aim of white terrorists of the past, like the Ku Klux Klan, which lynched black men, women, and yes, children. And although these protests by young people across the country are remarkable, we must remember that cop violence against African-American communities ain't a new thing. It was December 4th, 1969, 45 years ago, when cops raided the Monroe Street apartment building of young Black Panthers, including Deputy Chairman Fred Hampton of Chicago, Illinois. There, police, armed with submachine guns, shot Captain Mark Clark of Peoria, Illinois, and Deputy Chairman Fred Hampton as he slept in his bed next to his pregnant wife. Both Mark and Fred were killed. At least seven other Panthers were wounded by police gunfire as they laid in their beds. Not a single cop was ever charged with these murders or the aggravated assaults on members of the Black Panther Party. Next spring marks the 30th anniversary of the MOVE bombing, where cops dropped bombs from a helicopter and killed 11 men, women, and children, members and relatives of the Black naturalist group MOVE. 11 people burned and or shot to death, and two city blocks in Philadelphia turned to red bricks and ashes. And again, not a single cop ever even charged with anything. Only MOVE member Ramona Africa would ever go to jail, prison I should say, for riot for 7 years. The movement protesting police terrorism is a remarkable thing, but it didn't begin yesterday. Police terrorism is decades long, and it ain't about rotten apples or broken windows. It's about blocking a popular freedom movement and protecting a system of repression. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.